This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Chicago's Morning Answer. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. Thank you so much for joining us and being a part of the program this morning. We appreciate it and want you to be a part of the program with us. Give us a call at 312-642-5600. That's 312-642-5600. Or you can text us. Text DA and your message to 64636. Look forward to hearing from all of you. Typically with our Wonder Twin powers combined, Joe and I host Sources with Knowledge, heard weekends on this station, 8 a.m. on Saturdays, and again at 3 p.m. on Sundays. And if that sounds interesting or attractive to you, then you can search your friendly local podcast feed to find all previous episodes of Sources with Knowledge. Get yourself caught up before the weekend when the new episode drops. You know, it's, as we said yesterday, it's like one of those TV shows. You can't just, this isn't the Two and a Half Men.
We can just jump in.
We can just jump in at any point. You kind of know what's going on.
Right.
You really need the previous 68 episodes of the show before you get to episode 69, which will only seem to make a good amount of sense to you after you've heard the previous 68.
Yeah, there are too many layers to the show to just jump in willy-nilly on the 69th episode and think that everything just can be fine. You know, you're going to be lost. There are going to be plot holes that you're not going to be able to follow. So I recommend going to Spotify or iTunes or Podbean, wherever you get it, Stitcher, listen up. You have plenty of time before Saturday to do so. And again, maybe you don't know if you want to give us a chance yet. That's what today is for.
Yeah.
You have a chance today to kind of get acquainted with us. You have tomorrow. And then if you like what you're hearing, which I don't know why you would, but if you do, then Saturday, Sunday, and 68 previous episodes.
68 previous episodes to get caught up. It really is like the dark side of the moon of radio programs. So like every time you listen to it, you hear something you didn't hear the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You really need that full experience.
If you play it backwards.
I recommend also taking like psychedelics and just kind of watching Wizard of Oz and seeing how it lines up. Because, you know, at minimum, it won't harm the experience. It won't make it less of an experience. Probably it'll make it better.
Yeah. If you listen to it backwards, you might hear some things that were kind of snuck into the recording. So I recommend trying to do that too. It's really just a really layered, complicated show. And I'm fortunate that we have the opportunity to make it and that you have the opportunity to listen to it.
That's it's you that we're really happy for in this, in the circumstance. Joe, this has been the year of being stuck inside watching TV because, well, there's this whole pandemic thing that's been going on. And I found myself consuming a lot of, I've always been somebody who consumes a lot of entertainment media to start with. And the first couple months of it this year really made it more so. There were, particularly when we lost sports programming, I didn't really realize exactly how much sports I watched until it was just all gone all of a sudden.
It is weird because I didn't either, because that's usually what's on in the evenings.
Right.
For the most part, any given in month, really. I mean, there's usually a dead time around, I don't know, if your baseball team's not in the playoffs in October, there's a dead time on through the week when there's no football on. There are dead times throughout the year, but now, this past year, it's May, and there's no baseball on, there's no basketball on, there's no hockey on, there's nothing on. Mm-hmm. So it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, every day. It's just
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday,
it's the same. It's that Groundhog Day feeling. I mean, a lot of things contribute to that, but where there's nothing to look forward to as a sports fan or as a consumer of entertainment, if that's your main source of entertainment.
And then you had this experience where sports comes back on the air, and it's all on the air at the same time.
Which we underestimated how weird that would be.
We clearly did. I was actually looking last night at someone who was relaying the Christmas Day TV ratings for the National Basketball Association, which was down something like 50% from last year. And we talked about this on our program a while ago with the NBA Finals. and said, you know, there were a lot of people who wanted to attribute the outward social justice messaging of the NBA to why ratings were in decline for that league. But when you looked across the sports that had returned, they were all on at the same time. So you had the opportunity to watch baseball if you want to watch baseball. Hockey was on, and usually hockey was on starting at like 11 in the morning, which was glorious. And you had the NFL coming back. You had college football coming back. You had the NBA playoffs and finals going on. We looked at it and kind of thought, okay, I mean, you could see why ratings would be down, because you went from a period of nothing where people kind of acclimated to the lack of sporting events being on television to this period of time where you are just overloaded with options of what to watch. And it would make sense that ratings across the board would be down for all of this.
Yeah, so
and they've been declining for a while.
Yeah.
This is not a new phenomenon. It was just seemed to be exacerbated by the pandemic experience we were living through.
That made an even weirder experience, actually, than when there was nothing on, because you're forced to choose. And I thought everyone thought it'd be great once all sports came back, and it's like you have everything on at once. You have a football game the same day as you have a baseball game that's in the second or third month of the season, the same day as you have an NBA playoff game. This is amazing. But what you actually end up doing is being forced to choose, not even if they're on at the same time. You could be watching a basketball game and then decide you want to take a break, and because these are mashed up with every decision you make in the day. It's not just football versus basketball versus hockey. It's every decision you're making through the day. So if you're watching a basketball game in the evening, you might not want to flip over to the end of a football game on after, because you might want to take a break from your TV. You might want to do something else.
Right.
So that's it's just too much. It's very weird.
But when you look at the ratings for the Christmas Day, and that is something, the way that Monday night is owned by the NFL, and when you look at holidays too, Christmas is like the NBA's day. Ratings down like 50%. From last year. Joe, you're more of an NBA guy than I am, which is to say that you're an NBA guy at all. 50% decline, that seems incredible and stranger to me, just because there's less competition with it. Not just because the NHL isn't back yet and college football is in this bit of stasis in between the end of championship, league championship games, conference championship games, and the bowls and playoffs starting. There wasn't a lot of competition, and yet huge decline.
Well, this is the least hyped NBA season, probably one of the least hyped professional sports seasons I can remember in my lifetime, because the other season just ended. It was just around the corner. It's very weird because you have teams that were bad, say the Chicago Bulls, who hadn't played in like 300 days or something. Then you had the Miami Heat and Los Angeles Lakers, who just played. There was basically no offseason. The NBA draft just happened in November. People weren't ready for the start of the season. I mean, sports teams and leagues kind of depend, actually, on casual fans, because you're always going to have these people that are tuned into everything that's going on, but it's the more casual fans that really carry a team or carry a sport. And for casual fans, it's hard to jump into the next season when the other one just ended. There's no hype around anything because everyone's talking about the pandemic. I think really the pandemic takes a lot of mental headspace from people when sports are on TV and it's you only have one option. The pandemic just takes up so much space in your head that all of a sudden the start of the NBA season was very sudden from the last season just isn't as important anymore. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, we might see that when baseball starts. You might see a decline in the college football playoff ratings. You might see that a lot for a while because the pandemic is still just the dominating thing for most people.
I think there's something else at play as well, which the lack of fans in the stands had a bigger impact on all of this than I think I appreciated at the time that it was happening. And I found this driven home mostly in Major League Baseball, whereas with the NFL, the way the NBA did it with like kind of the weird screens in the background and in the NFL and the NBA and the National Hockey League, I found it the least distracting in the National Hockey League. They kind of covered the seats with tarps and you had ambient noise, which was pumped in. But your focus is so much on the ice that I didn't think as much about the lack of people in the stands.
Same with the NFL. You don't really get camera angles that show seats.
A whole lot of seats. You're really looking at the field. As long as that ambient noise bit is there, the crowd noise that they're pumping in, it seems fine. But with baseball, it's so unbelievably noticeable.
It's awful.
Because the primary angle that you're looking at, you see for most of the game, is from behind the pitcher looking at home plate. And you see all the people who are supposed to be sitting behind home plate, and they're not there. And as a New York Yankees fan, I'm used to that experience because nobody's ever sitting in like the $5,000 seats behind home plate at Yankee Stadium. But in most ballparks, you're used to seeing that. And even with the crowd noise pumped in, it's kind of like, eh, you know, so obvious.
The crowd noise pumped in makes it worse. I think if it was just empty seats, people would be somewhat okay with it and just lean into the fact that this is 2020. This is reality. I think it would be a better experience. But the fake crowd noise pumped in while you're staring at empty seats is so weird. It messes with your mind. It creates a very artificial experience that I think really does water down the viewing experience.
Yeah. We're saying all this to eventually get around to this article that I want to discuss that we'll discuss when we're back from the break of Richard Roper at the Chicago Sun-Times listing his best television shows for 2020. Want to know what you thought the best thing you watched, movie, television show, whatever it was in 2020, and you can tell us by giving us a call, 312-642-5600, or you can text your thoughts to DA and your message to 64636. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy. Yeah, talking about the NBA ratings being incredibly down for Christmas Day. This was... It's, again, not terribly surprising to me. Just the experience of, I don't know, it was a weird experience, Joe, because like as we were saying, we went through this period of not having any sports to entertain us and then having way too much. And it seems like we're only now approaching some kind of an equilibrium with things starting to get back into their normal schedules. Like, baseball was the only thing that stayed more or less on its normal schedule other than a period of time where it was supposed to be on the air and wasn't.
Yeah,
but it ended about the same time that it was supposed to.
It ended when it was supposed to, but it was on this... So that's weird because it was the only one that ended when it was supposed to, so it's kind of its own schedule, but it was the most diluted season and the most, I felt, fake season of anything.
Yeah.
But now next year, they're the only... league that's going to be has the opportunity to be in its entire full schedule. They'll probably find a way to mess it up, but they can have a normal season next year.
Yeah. Let's go to line one and Bill in Hoffman Estates. Bill, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. You guys are really trying to find excuses for why these ratings are down, and the simple fact is, yeah, people are pissed off about these social justice movements. Everybody I know is not watching. The games are always on at my house, and now they're not on. And it's as simple as that. It has nothing to do with the COVID. It has nothing to do with everything. Sick of this social justice movement, and everything's turned off. The football, the basketball, I've been watching it for years. Just turned it off. I got guys who don't go to the Bears games anymore. They're sick of it.
Thanks for the call, Bill. It's a yes and. I mean, it's a yes and. There's more than just that, because that stuff has been going on for a while in a number of different leagues. And to a certain extent, it's part of the NBA's brand now and has been for a while. And I think there are people, I agree with Bill in a certain sense, I think there are people who are a bit exhausted by all of this stuff, because we typically have looked to sports to be a distraction. And there have been moments throughout history where social and cultural movements have aligned with the world of sports. Like Jackie Robinson is a perfect example of all of that. But that was the kind of thing that was going on in the world writ large and became represented in there. Not the kind of thing that was, you know, moved along by slogans on the back of jerseys. You cannot rule out the bizarreness of the year contributing to the ratings that we're seeing. It's yes. And
I would even go that far. I think we shouldn't overrate our own experiences. He said that everyone he knows is not listening to it. I don't know a single person personally that is not watching sports because of social justice statements. I don't know a single person. And I'm not going to overrate my experience to say that nobody's doing it. I know that people are, but it's so
sure.
Marginal that people are doing that. And that it's not the thing that's moving the ratings at all. So I wouldn't even say it's yes and. I would say it's an oh, by the way. I don't think it's even that big of a factor.
But part of it is it is very difficult to calibrate that because we're talking about
ratings that are 50% down year over year.
I think you're right in that it's not the it is a factor. It is not the leading factor. I think there are. And you see this trajectory for a while now, too, that you have seen people's interest in all of this starting to wane. I just don't think you can rule out the bizarreness of this year and the change in the way that people experience the event. I really think there is something about watching the game with people in the stands with the thought that you could be in the stands at some point watching it in person. And because you're not getting that kind of filtered experience, you're not seeing other people enjoying it, you feel differently about it. So I think there's a lot of things going on there, and it's not the kind of thing that we can oversimplify, although I think this stuff has something to do with it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Be part of the program with us. Give us a call at 312-642-5600 or text DAN your message to 64636. In the Chicago Sun-Times, Richard Roper, also known as below replacement level Roger Ebert, is out with a list of the best TV shows of 2020. And, Joe, there's a lot of talk that we're living through this period of the golden age of television, that there are just incredible programs out left and right, and there are so many different options. And I typically consume a lot of these. And I'm just kind of blown away by how I'm going through this list. Not only have I only seen one of these shows, there are a bunch in here I haven't even heard of.
Same. I mean, I've seen two of them. I've seen let's go through the list. I've seen the top two, which is Queen's Gambit on Netflix and The Last Dance, number one, which originally aired on ESPN. And now is on Netflix. But 10 through 3, The Flight Attendant, Big Sky, Next, Fear City, Bridgerton,
mm-hmm.
High Fidelity, The Wilds, I'll Be Gone, In the Dark. There are a couple there I haven't even heard of. I mean, there are some that I'm aware of from different streaming platforms and have kind of just glossed over because I know, even if I know they're critically acclaimed, I'm kind of like, eh. It's not pulling me in. But yeah, it is interesting. There's the list of the top movies of 2022 that came out this week, I think also in the Sun-Times. And I kind of had the same reaction. I had heard of like three of the movies.
Yeah, I'm looking at that list right now. I will say number 10 on the list, Palm Springs, which is a comedy starring Christine Milioti and Andy Samberg.
I've been meaning to watch that, actually.
It is good. It is very much in a Groundhog Day kind of vein. It's a really interesting take on all of that. And in a period of time where so much of pop culture is recycled, it's not that we can't do a similar idea over again. I mean, there's that theory that you can boil every story down to A Stranger Comes to Town. We can do the same idea in different ways, but this was actually really interesting, a very interesting one. I recommend it. I think it's available on, Netflix or Amazon Prime.
The reason that they recycle so many ideas too is there are sure things. I mean, the industry wants to take a chance on sure things. They don't want to take risks and take on more independent, more creative projects. This is why you have sequels in remakes of a lot of different movies. That's why you have Coming to America coming out, because they know what's going to make money. They know what a sure thing is going to be, and that's why you get the same ideas recycled over and over.
Yeah, see, that's the thing about like even the Coming to America. I don't know how much of a sure thing that is.
For money, that's going to make a ton of money.
I don't know.
It absolutely will.
I don't. Joe, when was the last good Eddie Murphy movie?
I'm not saying it's going to be good. I don't think it'll be good.
But what is the... I don't know about this. I love the original. The original is like,
Top 10
30 years old now?
80s, yeah.
Yeah.
80s.
it just does not seem obvious to me that's the kind of thing that there's a screaming amount of demand for, that is going to, you know, it's a question of if it's going to make money, it's a question of budget versus what it pulls in. I don't know. I have a harder time visualizing that there is going to be a whole bunch of people that are really going to be all that interested in a sequel to Coming to America 30 years later.
I've just from people I've talked to about this. I mean, this is an anecdotal thing. We just got through talking about anecdotal experiences about watching sports. I think there's a lot of demand within the demographic of people who grew up loving that movie. Who will end up seeing it one way or the other, depending on how the distribution is kind of in question too.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on how it's distributed, but I think there's going to be that movie's guaranteed to make money. Depending on how much, I mean, it's not going to make. I think the question really is how much money does it make, and you know it's not going to lose money is the thing, and that's when you start the Netflix or whoever is going to take more chances on things that they know are not going to lose money in a sequel, a remake. A rehashed idea that's been created 25 times on Hallmark. There are certain things that are not going to lose money, and that's the thing that's going to get made. So it's refreshing to see something that's different.
I agree with that. The number one program, we talked about this on our show, Sources with Knowledge, heard weekends on the station, 8 a.m. on Saturdays and 3 p.m. on Sundays. The Last Dance, which was captivating. And for somebody who is not a fan of the NBA, I found it an incredible watching experience, if not only for just the memes that could be pulled out of Michael Jordan in that show.
Part of it, yeah.
But I thought they – look, there is certainly an amount of curation that is going on there. Michael Jordan, I believe, is an executive producer of the program. So he is putting forward – to some extent, the image that he wants people to see. But even in the image he wants people to see, there were some kind of nakedly honest takes from him and representations of who he is in a way that, like, I came away knowing, going into it, I knew, obviously, the legend of Michael Jordan, know that he is arguably the greatest player ever to play in the National Basketball Association. And you come away from it with this impression of him that, here's a guy who's just absolutely, completely driven to succeed to the point where he seemed to make up reasons to help motivate himself, things that like didn't happen in order to tell the stories to himself, to motivate himself. And he doesn't seem to be all that happy as a result of being the greatest player ever to play in the NBA.
That's a big takeaway. And it's interesting that was a takeaway all of us had when he had creative input on the final product. And what we saw was a guy who wasn't totally happy, who was kind of driven, just kind of suffered through all of it. And that is what we ended up seeing with his input, which is really interesting. I love The Last Dance. It was appointment television for me, which it had been a while since there was something that was appointment television on a cable network. It was very weird to have to tune in on Sunday at a certain time to watch it. But I'm surprised how big it is just across the board. With you said you're not a big NBA fan, but there are people who just aren't big sports fans that love The Last Dance, and it made number one on this list. I was kind of surprised by.
I think something else that is interesting about this list, and to me there's a glaring omission, but there's all of these programs are so incredibly serious. Mm-hmm. And I've thought for a while now, particularly when it comes to movies, that we don't make a lot of good movie comedies anymore. And this was driven home to me by a Thanksgiving ritual that my wife and I have, which is we watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And it's a movie. There are a lot of movies we talk about that we say you can't make that anymore. And usually what we mean by that is something like Blazing Saddles, where the comedy that exists in Blazing Saddles is just not something that would ever get sign-off by studios in Hollywood. But this is a movie that you can't make anymore because the logistics of it are impossible. The idea of Steve Martin having to hail a cab in New York City to rush to the airport to get on this flight, and the flight gets canceled, and he ends up taking a train, and he ends up renting a car. And he's out of touch with his wife for extended periods of time between when he can find a payphone. The fact that you have an incredibly powerful computer in your pocket eliminates those communication problems that make the movie funny. It's another reason I think that romantic comedies in particular aren't all that funny anymore, because so many of them rely on some kind of miscommunication that is going on. And we have so many communication mechanisms available that we over-communicate. And that is our standard now, is over-communicating. And we've taken away those circumstances created by being out of touch with others that lend itself to comedy. And we just can't make those movies anymore. And writers seem to not have figured out how to use the technology we have and the way that we have miscommunications through that technology to make anything that I found entertaining.
Sure. I think a big problem, too, is they'll find something that kind of works. And I'm not saying it makes a good movie, but gets a good cast, makes money, is well-produced, whatever. And then comedies end up kind of following an algorithm where they're not really telling a story. They're telling a situation. They're just setting up a situation. And you know what happens within the first 20 minutes of the movie. You know everything that's going to play out. This mm-hmm. is every comedy that comes out pretty much every year. And comedies don't have to be bad. I think we've kind of grown accustomed the last 20 years to thinking all comedy movies are kind of bad, and it's just whatever, it's entertaining. We know what's going to happen the first 15 minutes. It is what it is. But it's just because they're telling a situation. They're not telling a story. They're just setting up this thing that could have been a sitcom. It could have been 30 minutes. It could have been 15 minutes.
Yes.
And drawing it out over 90 minutes. Or if it's a Judd Apatow movie, 2 hours and 20 minutes. And it's just the same movie over and over again. We've seen the same last 20 years, I'd say, we've seen the same comedy 50 times.
At least. Which, to me, the glaring omission from this list of the best TV shows of 2020 is not just the best comedy program that I watched in 2020, but I think the best TV show that I watched in 2020, which is on Apple TV Plus, and it is Ted Lasso.
Everyone liked that, yeah.
It is, Joe, if you haven't seen it, you have to see it. It's phenomenal. This is Jason Sudeikis comedy that is based on a commercial that NBC made for Premier League Soccer like 7 years ago, where the conceit is one of the British Premier League football, or as we would say, soccer teams, as they would say, football, hire a American college football coach with all the kind of like Southern spun college football coach tropes to coach this British Premier League soccer team. And the thing that struck me about this show is, one, it actually is legitimately funny. It's not funny in the kind of contrived, I'm laughing because I think I'm supposed to laugh here kind of way, which is like my experience with the last several seasons of The Office, where it was like, okay, I know I'm supposed to laugh at this. Or even that kind of cringeworthy, awkward stuff that I can only take so much of in those kinds of comedies that are being, TV comedies that are being made now and still being made now. It was legitimately funny, and it is a show without a villain. Everybody has somehow been wronged in this show, but it is also just the character that Jason Sudeikis plays, Ted Lasso, is capable of this remarkable kind of forgiveness. Of the premise of the show is that he is being hired by the woman who owns this team, who got it in a divorce from her scumbag husband, and she wants to ruin the team to exact some revenge on him. And there's this theme of forgiveness that runs through the program that is just incredible. And to me, struck me just the kind of the kind of message it was wonderful to see in what was such a trying and difficult year.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of great things about that, and it is on my list of things to watch. But something that I've noticed, I wanted to ask you about this, is I've also used the time in the – so, like, I haven't gotten around to it yet. I've used a lot of time in the pandemic to get back to things in the last few years, shows, movies, that I never ended up getting around to at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard this experience from a lot of people who've watched classic TV shows that just never ended up watching because they didn't have the time or enough interest at the time to get into. So I finally watched The Americans, which had been over already.
Phenomenal TV
show. I rewatched The Sopranos for like the third time. I'm in the middle of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is started a couple of years ago now. So I'm getting back to shows that I didn't watch at the time because I just had a million other things going on. And I think that's been the experience of a lot of people too, where they're rewatching shows that they just never got around to 10 years ago. And then, I mean, eventually I'll get around to Ted Lasso. Yeah. Eventually I'll get around to I'm going to start Lilyhammer pretty soon. Like, all these other shows that are coming up now. It's like, I feel like almost like I'm 3 years behind what's happening in streaming. And I wonder if that's the case for a lot of people, because you and I are looking at this list going, I haven't heard of half of these.
Yeah, you just bumped up for me rewatching The Americans, because if you've not seen The Americans, it is a fantastic program. And I'm thinking even more about it now, because if you're not a subscriber to Conan O'Brien's podcast, Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. One, it's an excellent podcast. But the most recent episode is him talking to Matthew Reese, who plays Philip Jennings, the lead, one of the two leads in The Americans. The amazing thing is just he has this incredibly dignified and pronounced Welsh accent that he never used. Like, hearing him talk and knowing what he seems like in the program, it's one of those that, like, if you hear Nicole Kidman speak and she has this Australian accent, it's kind of like, oh, okay, I can kind of see how that works. But him, it's kind of, I just expect the normal voice to come out of him. But yes, if you've not seen The Americans, highly recommend that. Want to know what, if you had a favorite program of the year or anything you loved, didn't love, want to love on, want to hate on, give us a call, 312-642-5600, or text us, DA and your message to 64636. Ericone, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Ericone, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. Joe, another program that's not on this list, which doesn't completely surprise me because the list is from Richard Roper, who is, again, as I said, below replacement level Roger Ebert and likes to spend most of his time smelling his own farts.
But he should call in if he wants to.
Yeah, absolutely. You can call in. We'll have a nice discussion. The Mandalorian, which is on Disney Plus. It is the first television show of the Star Wars franchise and is, unlike the grading on a scale, on a curve that we've done for most of the Star Wars products that have come out since the original trilogy, is legitimately good. And if you think you don't like Star Wars or science fiction, fantasy kind of stuff, it really is just a Western. That's really what the program is a Western. And the second season is very, very good and highly recommendable.
A lot of people that don't really follow or just aren't big Star Wars fans got into The Mandalorian. I think a real benefit that's underplayed is this, and why The Mandalorian was able to do things that the sequel movies weren't able to do, is the benefit of being able to produce a content that can be 42 minutes, 37 minutes, 55 minutes, whatever you want, without commercial breaks, instead of, we need to make this movie that's 2 hours and 15 minutes that needs to check all these boxes in terms of diversity, in terms of all these other stuff, and try to make $1 billion off it. It's a totally different experience creatively.
You don't need to make everything the Peter Jackson director's cut of Lord of the Rings, which comes out at like 4 hours. Like, things that should be 4 hours long are like Lawrence of Arabia, Gone with the Wind, and really we don't need to do that anymore. It's like even Scorsese with was the mob movie from Scorsese.
The Irishman.
Which one? Yeah, The Irishman, which was a completely unnecessary, like, third hour of that.
And what, here's the take about The Irishman. Do we really, it's like you said, the mob movie from Scorsese.
Yeah,
do we really need more? Like, it was good. Like, if you had, that
just
was your,
rewatch Goodfellas.
If that's your introduction to Scorsese mob movies, I feel like you wouldn't want to go back and see Goodfellas, because you'd be like, Why am I doing this again?
Which is a testament to what people do with a lot of these streamable programs. They watch The Office over and over again because they don't want to take the chance that something will suck.
Right.
And it's the exact reason why, rather than watching The Irishman, you should just go ahead and rewatch Goodfellas, because it's not going to be better than Goodfellas.
And they don't want to give 100% of their attention. And I'm not saying that as a dig.
No,
I do this too. I'll throw on something that I consider background noise so I can be on my phone during it. But that's a lot of what they're making content for.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy on Chicago's Morning Answer. Be a part of the program with us. Give us a call at 312-642-5600. That's 312-642-5600. Or text us. Text DA and your message to 64636. That's DA and your message to 64636. You can find Joe and I hosting the program Sources with Knowledge weekends on this station, News Talk 560, The Answer, at 8 a.m. on Saturdays and then again at 3 p.m. on Sundays. You can look us up on your friendly local podcast feed, and we encourage you to check us out there. Joe, the Chicago City Council is populated by a bunch of ridiculous petty tyrants. Mm-hmm. Who would 50 be 50 of them who would be completely incapable in almost every case of making a positive contribution of society. They're not making a particularly positive contribution to society as members of the city council, but they would be incapable of doing one if they were not politicians. It's really the only game that they know. And yeah, that's all I got to say about that. No.
We'll see you tomorrow.
That's the good day, everybody. That is the kind of statement that stands alone. But Joe, this story is just amazing. You may remember the name Proco Joe Moreno, former alderman in the city council, former First Ward alderman. He was charged with several misdemeanors on Monday, yesterday, including driving under the influence. Which is nothing to laugh about, but in this case, the things accruing to him.
Yeah. Well, anytime you use the phrase including driving under the influence. Yeah.
After he allegedly crashed into several vehicles in the Gold Coast on Sunday night, Moreno, 48, was charged with two counts of driving under the influence, one count of reckless driving, five counts of failing to report damage to an unattended vehicle, according to Chicago police. This happened about 9:20 p.m. on Sunday, the 1200 block of North Astor Street. After the crash, he was taken to Northwestern Memorial Hospital in good condition. The first thing that popped into my mind, Joe, when I saw this was, what is it with this dude and his cars?
Right.
Because this is not the first, it's far from the first incident involving Alderman Moreno. That was strange. If you go back to January 2019, which was only about 2 years ago, but feels like about 10,000 years ago, the Chicago Police Department opened an investigation into whether Moreno filed a false police report when he had reported his car was stolen. And the police found the car and arrested the woman behind the wheel. However, she had proof that Moreno had loaned her the car with text messages to back up her story. I mean, I guess... at least it's a different type of car scandal for him. But seriously, dude, what the heck?
He didn't physically hurt or endanger anybody like the DUI. But, I mean, there's a pattern with this guy where you just kind of think, you know, after three, four, five incidents where you're having run-ins with either Chicago police or accused of inappropriate behavior, and we can go through the list, but you kind of think,
fool me once,
yeah.
Shame on me. Fool me twice, you're the first ward in Chicago. Fool me three times, you're still the first ward in Chicago. And by the fourth or fifth time, I mean, people really start to get fed up.
And you should, you know, not be, I mean, he's not anymore, but you should not be in public office at a certain point. In 2017, he was caught on video threatening a business owner. 2018, he was accused of impersonating a police officer after flashing a badge distributed to aldermen as peace officers, not police officers, as peace officers, to compel a woman to move her cars again, so he could take the parking spot in the Wrigleyville neighborhood, which is hard to get a parking spot sometimes. You mentioned the 2019 incident where he accused a woman of stealing his car again in 2019, in May of 2019.
That's when he turned himself into authorities for the warrant that was issued for his arrest for filing a false police report and insurance fraud. He pled not guilty to that in June 2019. This one, Joe, is my favorite. In February 2019, a former staffer accused Moreno of inappropriate behavior, which I have a hard time believing that, given the stories we've just told you, that he would be capable of inappropriate behavior.
And this is unbecoming of a politician.
He seems to be just a paragon of honor and virtue. A former staffer accused him of inappropriate behavior. She said in 2015, Moreno said to her and other aides, and this is, again, I don't know if this is her paraphrasing or if we actually have a transcript of this, but I'm just going to give you the quote that I have here. Okay, we're going to have a contest. Okay, already not off to a good start. Like, if you, you're an alderman, you work in government, and the thing we don't want to hear is, we're going to have a contest. The chances that that is going somewhere good, slim to none. We're going to have a contest. Everyone's going to have to take off their shirts. The girls can keep their bras on. Oh. At least he's keeping it like PG-13. He's keeping it PG-13 there. And if your body is better than mine, then you get a raise.
Everyone got a raise. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, this is just... I mean, we joke on our show. I shouldn't even say joke. I say on our show a lot, Sources with Knowledge, Saturdays at 8 a.m., Sundays at 3 p.m., about politicians who kind of have sociopathic behavior. I mean, to even get into this field to begin with, you got to be a little off. And then to perpetually be running, especially for Chicago aldermen, where you have a little fiefdom.
Yeah.
I think that's a good motivation to run. Not good motivation, but it is a powerful motivation to run.
Yes.
You just got to be a little off. And this is kind of, I mean, is a long laundry list here, but it's the kind of behavior becoming of somebody that would want to have a little fiefdom, that would want to have power like this in a position that is just too much power and just elicits people who are a little off.
No, it what's amazing to me is the kind of final entry before we get to the incident that happened Sunday night where he sideswiped 8 cars over 4 blocks, you know, which is just, I mean... Over 4 blocks. I'm amazed he only got 8 cars. It's kind of impressive almost. Moreno's name, this is so banal compared to everything else. Moreno's name came up in the federal investigation of Alderman Ed Burke and Alderman Danny Solis when a campaign donor said Moreno had steered property zoning tax work his way in exchange for support. And that's the kind of thing that the whole property tax gambit in Illinois and what we're seeing with the indictments of Ed Burke, what we're seeing with a lot of the conversations surrounding Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. By the way, we're going to be talking at 8:30 this morning with our friend Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute about the future for Mike Madigan. Is the story is typically not what is the corruption is not what is illegal. It is what is legal. And the property tax gambit in Chicago, in the suburbs, in the whole state of Illinois, that would typically be like the big scandal being wrapped up with Ed Burke and everything he's going through would be the big scandal. And somehow, Joe Moreno goes above and beyond the call of duty in order to provide us this kind of, and again, nobody got hurt. Don't drink and drive, folks. That's nothing to laugh at.
Tony La Russa, if you're listening, call in.
Tony La Russa, if you're out there, hey, let's have a conversation about it.
Pull over first before you call in.
Definitely pull over, and not in the middle of an intersection where you fall asleep.
Find a parking spot.
That didn't turn out so well for you the last time. But it is worth laughing at just the ridiculousness of people like Alderman Joe Moreno.
It is, and it's just you have to kind of laugh at it almost when there's just the huge list of infractions against a public, what you should be a public servant. But there's a problem with it where I think in Illinois and especially Chicago, we just kind of adopted this issue of our politicians are sleazebags. It's almost like an identity, like deep dish pizza or like
a
sports team. It's like our politicians suck. They're sleazebags. Yeah. They're corrupt. We have a history of corruption and it's the Chicago way, blah, 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 blah. But that apathy and that joking nature of it is why you get people like Joe Moreno who, after 5 serious infractions, can still be considered a credible person in the public sphere.
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of this stuff happened before he lost his reelection bid in 2019. Really, the story was reported in February around election time of 2019 of something that happened in 2015 where he's doing the everyone take their shirts off thing. But, Joe, you make a good point. In a previous life, I ran political campaigns here in Chicago, Cook County area. And one of the biggest challenges that we always faced was How do you get people to care about the corruption issue? It's so pervasive. It's such an embedded part of the culture that the reaction people have to things that should make them lose their minds and say, everybody even remotely associated with this, we are going to toss them out immediately. And the reaction that you get from people is, don't go back to the Blagojevich stuff, where it's kind of like, oh, he's trying to sell a Senate seat. What's for dinner?
Yeah.
That's the reaction.
Doesn't hurt me.
Even
yeah.
when you try to put a price tag on it, that's difficult as well. It just, for some reason, it does not process. It does not sink in. The willingness to accept these kind of people, and believe me, there are plenty of other people in the Chicago City Council like Joe Moreno. And we just kind of accept it for what it is.
Yeah, and I think just my gut reaction is corruption or poor behavior from a public official resonates more when it hits to fairness. So you see people mad online. I mean, even this didn't amount to anything, but you see people who are irked by the idea of we have to be in our homes locked down, but J.B. Pritzker can go to Lake Geneva, can go to Florida, can go to the Bahamas, whatever.
The quintessential example of this, the mayor of Austin, Texas, recording a message telling people not to travel and doing it from Cabo San Lucas.
Yes, exactly. Gavin Newsom going to French Laundry. That idea of this isn't fair seems to resonate more. But even that in Illinois doesn't always penetrate. So that's the thing. And I know you've, when you've worked on political campaigns, have obviously, I try to ask this question all the time. How does corruption resonate? I think the answer is it has to relate to that idea of fairness. But even then, our history of corruption in the state, and especially in the city of Chicago, is so deep and so it just is.
And in a way, we expect to be entertained by it.
Yeah.
Like that's the
Blagojevich
reason.
Is entertaining.
The Blagojevich as an entity was so bizarre and so brazen. Which is why I think in many ways Pat Quinn, I don't know if corruption is quite the right word for him, but he did a lot of typical Illinois politician things that you can argue are corrupt. But he was just so boring and condescending about it that at least Blagojevich was entertained. We expect to be entertained by all this stuff. And it just kind of is. It just kind of becomes something that we accept, even though we really, really shouldn't. 312-642-5600 if you want to be a part of the program with us today, or text us. Text DA in your message to 64636. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and how do we get people like Joe Moreno in office? Is it a lack of options? What could possibly explain it? Joe, I've got part of the explanation. Our friend Austin Berg, who is coming up later in the program to talk about House Speaker Mike Madigan, has a really good book called The New Chicago Way, in which he examines a lot of reforms that would make Chicago a better city, a better managed city, a better governed city. And one of the things that I got initially from his book and then have read about in other places, and you see this in a lot of major cities. New York is another example of it. New York is going to have an election coming up for mayor. Arguably, one of the more powerful and important positions in America. New York is an incredibly important city in this country. And the election is going to be in 2021, in an off year election.
Yep.
We do the same thing in Chicago. We hold elections in February, which is usually the primary stage of it, and in a city with one nonpartisan elections, but to the extent that they are partisan, it doesn't matter because the Republicans never win, and the primaries usually determine who wins these races. In February.
You ever been in Chicago?
In Chicago. It's where the weather is lovely, especially that time of year. And a big reason behind this, and you hear a lot of people on the left who want to talk about voter suppression. You hear Stacey Abrams from Georgia banging on about how voter suppression cost her the governor's race down there. You want an example of where voter suppression goes on? I'll give you an example of where voter suppression goes on. Here in Chicago. And the people who are the culprits behind it are the unions. The unions are largely in favor of having elections in times like February in Chicago. Because if turnout is 10% of the city and they can turn out all their members and the family members of their members, they are a dominant coalition. If you get 50% turnout, 60, 70% turnout, they're a rounding error. And they can dictate the terms and the stakes as a result of that.
And when you say voter suppression, I think when people think of voter suppression, they think of oftentimes active shenanigans on election day to try to dissuade people from voting. But we're talking about something that is designed every time there's an election to get less people to vote. This is the election being in February is designed to get less people to vote, to keep it that way so less people vote. And that is a form of literally that's what we're
saying.
That
is voter suppression.
Suppressing votes.
Yes.
If it was in June, more people would vote. You can't argue with that at all. And yeah, it's really we take it for granted, too, because it's not something that is nefarious on its face. Having an election in February isn't just outright. There's no corrupt nature of that when you just say there's an election the second week of February or whatever.
Yeah. Other than the complete intention behind it.
Right. But that's what almost makes it more nefarious.
Yeah.
Is it's secretly.
It just seems like, well,
you
know, it's just it's Chicago. It's when we do things. We do things in February of off years. That's how we do things. Same thing, again, with the mayor of New York City. City Council in New York is another big mess that they actually have publicly funded elections for City Council in New York. But without like a full-time staff to do the paperwork to be in compliance with that, it is almost completely impossible to comply with that. So it is an incumbency protection racket to have public funding of elections. And these things that are often sold by people as reforms, publicly funding elections to get money out of politics, are really just ways that people in power use the system to keep themselves in power.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy. Give us a call to be a part of the program, 312-642-5600. That's 312-642-5600. Or you can text us. Text DA and your message to 64636. That's DA and your message to 64636 to be a part of the program today. Joe, headline here in the Chicago Sun-Times is the first nursing homes in Illinois get vaccines as the coronavirus death toll in the state tops 16,000. Five frontline workers received the first doses of the Moderna vaccine on Monday afternoon. It was a big day in the city's vaccine rollout, according to Dr. Allison Arwadi, the city's public health commissioner. We're now starting to see the vaccine get delivered in different states and starting to have the conversation, which we should have been having for quite a while. But we really just kind of have glossed over of what should the prioritization be for who gets these first. The New York Times had this fairly interesting program. You could go there. You could plug in certain basic information about yourself, whether or not you were a frontline worker, truly essential worker, police, fire, medical personnel, age, whether you're married and have kids. Several other pieces of information, and it tells you approximately where you are in line for the vaccine. And I did that, and I'm somewhere around, like, you know, the 250 millionth place or something like that, because I'm young enough, healthy enough, not living with somebody who has a lot of comorbidities and would be heavily at risk for this. I'm much further down in the list. That makes sense. But what we're seeing a lot of And what I think is debatable is the value of giving it to politicians early on in the process of distributing the vaccine. And there's the argument, the positive argument for this would be that they're supposed to be leaders, supposed to be modeling good behavior. We want people to get the vaccine. So they're going to go ahead and take it, and often have been doing so publicly, if not just sharing images on their social media. They have been doing it live on television. Joe Biden did that, and he's not exactly a politician, but Dr. Anthony Fauci did that.
And the argument for that is to set the example that
yes.
we're doing it, you should do it too.
But for every vaccine dose, because these things are coming out as fast as they could be produced, but they are not – it's still a rollout process. But every vaccine that goes to a politician is not going to somebody who arguably needs it a whole lot more than they do.
Right. I mean, the whole – and the New York Times takes this into consideration with that algorithm that you mentioned, is the most vulnerable and the most exposed, and then trying to figure out, based on those two factors, how what priority should be to get you the vaccine. So, I mean, frontline workers are among the most exposed, the most vulnerable are the oldest among us, those with pre-existing conditions. And that it's a really weird concept to try to think about. We're all going through this together. We're all in this pandemic, but who do we need to put in the front of the line? And that already puts us in a weird headspace of we're trying to prioritize the importance of people in a way based on real things. But you're exposed to it every single day if you're a frontline worker
mm-hmm.
or you're elderly or you have underlying health conditions. These are real things that we should take into consideration. But if we're trying to say who's most important to protect first, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez getting the vaccine, 30, 31, however old she is,
Notably not old enough to run for president.
Yeah, not vulnerable. You want to make the argument that she's exposed because she has this job where she has to travel for. I would argue not really an essential job. Everyone in Congress is, and I don't mean this in a crass way of they could all die or anything, but all replaceable. If they didn't feel safe doing their job, we'll find someone else to do it.
Oh, to the point.
It's not going to medical school.
Between every 2 and 6 years, we have the explicit opportunity to replace them
yeah.
if we want.
I would argue nurses and doctors are not as replaceable because these are skills that take a lot of education to acquire and experiences. And I can't do what they do. I could be a roll call vote in Springfield or
yeah.
Washington or wherever.
In the immortal words of the film Tommy Boy, that, you know, oh, there are people that there are plenty of people who go to college for 12 years. Yeah, they're called doctors.
Right, right.
It takes a long time in order to get the qualifications that one needs in order to do that kind of work.
Yeah.
And I just am unpersuaded by the argument that having these people move to the front of the line to set an example is really all that meaningful. I think the people who understand that they need to get the vaccine, for the most part, are going to get it. And as long as we are vaccinating the people who truly need it, the biggest priorities, not just those who are serving on the front lines of the medical industry and the health industry, but those who are truly vulnerable, we are on the path to where we want to get to the herd immunity that we need in order to get back to a normal functioning society. And politicians just do not rank that high. Well, with, I guess, the only notable exception that so many of them seem to be geriatric.
That's the one thing, yeah.
Yeah, that is, right. that is the one qualifier, is that we just had an election between two people in their 70s. For president of the United States. Other than that, you look at people like, you look at the leaders, Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi. These are all people who are up there in age. That, to me, is the only compelling argument
yeah.
for why they should be getting it.
I was going to say, to his credit, J.B. Pritzker has said that he's going to wait till his turn comes up to take the COVID vaccine. But maybe he has the argument to have it come up soon because, you know, he's not the most healthy guy in the world. But like, I agree with you 1,000,000%, but I'll even take it a step back. I'll even entertain the argument that Joe Biden Kamala Harris and Nancy Pelosi, even being third in line, should all. I'll entertain that argument that they can get the vaccine soon. I don't know even know if I agree with it, but I'll entertain that. You can't tell me that rank and file members of Congress, that governors, mm-hmm. that mayors, that state representatives, whoever, however far down the line you want to go, are of more importance than vaccinating people who are at risk.
If the argument is that, oh, they have to travel, they have to get to Washington, D.C. in order to do their jobs, I would come back to that with, no, they don't.
Yeah, no.
We live in the 21st century. We live at a period of time where I can press some buttons on my phone and have my groceries delivered to me. They can vote by proxy. There is just no reason 100%. I see. They held Zoom hearings for Amy Coney Barrett. They don't all need to be in the same room at the same time.
We're all working from home right now. They can work from home. Their job is way less important anyway. It's not an essential job. And even like the stuff, if governors were starting to get the vaccine, like the stuff you do to travel for, you don't need to visit flood damage. You don't need to cut the ribbon at a school. You can stay home. Do your work remotely.
Yeah. Let's go to line one and Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin. Marvin, good morning.
Good morning. I love the subject, you know. Are these lawmakers essential? They are unessential. Absolutely, extremely unessential. I think there are more laws on the books than we need. I don't think they need to make any more new laws. I think they need to take some laws away and give us some more freedom. I think that would be a useful job for these unuseful idiots, because everything that they do goes bad. They cannot do one thing, hardly one thing, without screwing it up. I'd like to know if there is one thing that they don't screw up. And another comment about the vaccine. I thought all these Democrats said that this is a terrible thing. Don't take it, because the evil
Kamala Harris said explicitly that.
So why are they in such a in line to take it all of a sudden?
Marvin,
you know, I thought they were lining up.
I'm going to tell you something, Marvin. I'm going to tell you something that's going to surprise you. Politicians are often hypocrites.
Yeah, I know.
Shocker.
I'm just trying to restate the absurd. But they are absolutely, unbelievably inefficient, ineffective, and cost way too much money. And it's I wish the American people would wake up and realize that, because it's us against them. Everything that they take from us is something that we can't do, and we never get it back.
Marvin, thank you so much for the call. It's amazing when you look at, and we talked about this some yesterday, the way that people in their own private lives and capacities, the private sector, adapted. How remarkably adaptable we were. And the big story that demonstrates this is something we also mentioned yesterday. The Moderna vaccine was developed in 48 hours over a weekend in January of this year, before the first official death from coronavirus in the United States was reported. 48 hours to develop that. It's taken 9 months to get it through the red tape, the bureaucratic labyrinth, the Byzantine crap fest that is the FDA. The same people who screwed up the testing regime in the very beginning, because the CDC said, we don't want a whole bunch of independent tests out there. All the tests are going to be produced by us. We're going to get them out there. And they screwed it up royally. You look at the clear examples of the way that people in the private sector in their private lives have adapted so incredibly fast to be able to handle the circumstances, and compare it to the way that lawmakers and politicians and bureaucracies and government has been slow, if not completely unable, to adapt. It's stunning if it weren't completely predictable.
It speaks volumes. We talked about this yesterday. The innovation and creativity of small business owners, particularly restaurant owners, bar owners, who have tried to make it work when the rules and the laws have been stacked against them to just stay alive, has been impressive and inspiring. That kind of creativity, that kind of innovation would never be realized by bureaucrats, by politicians. I mean, the whole idea of essential work has forced us to evaluate so many things in our economy and society about the idea of who's essential. And you argue everyone's essential.
Yes, but that is, to me, was one of the truly galling things people argued about this.
I do not like the question.
Oh, what kind of jobs are essential? You know, even in the point of sports aren't essential. We heard that a lot, which is one of the reasons why it's like, okay, it's fine that these leagues are suspended. Sports aren't essential. We don't need to have sports. The people who work the jobs that support those leagues, the people who are beer vendors at Wrigley and at Comiskey, people who sell the tickets, who work in the front offices, ask anybody if they think their job is essential. To them, their job is essential. And who the hell are these people with a pretense of knowledge about what people's lives are like just because they managed to win a glorified popularity or beauty contest to get into some kind of political office to tell us, oh, your job's not essential, we can just send you home?
Yeah, with sports, you're not just telling Chris Bryant that he can't work. You're telling the ground screw. You're telling the hot dog vendors. It's a whole thing. And the whole argument about trying to decide who's essential is just kind of offensive. But what we found through that is, even when we, you know, designating who's essential, who's not essential, yeah, I need my produce stocked at my local Mariano's more than I need my congressman, Mike Quigley, in my life. I don't need my politicians are way less essential to me.
Yes.
We're actually going to go through that evaluation to decide who's essential, who's important for us to function day to day as a society. My local grocer is way more essential to me than my local representative. And it's not even close. It's not even close. Those are people that I want vaccinated first. If we're going to have to prioritize certain people in our world, the politicians are going to be at the very, if we're discounting, you know, who's most vulnerable, the as we said, there are a lot of geriatrics in politics. If we're discounting that, politicians rank very low on the essential scale. Very low.
If you just think for a moment about grocery stores, you can be truly awed by the existence of grocery stores, that they take these products from all over the world in many cases, ingredients into a lot of those products from all over the world, and somehow they end up right there on the shelf. They're incredibly important, incredibly essential. And the way that you get these people talking about, oh, well, you know, we need to decide what's really important in the world. They don't know. Don't believe them when they say that they know. They don't know. It's the pretense of knowledge, not knowledge itself. 312-642-5600 if you want to be a part of the program with us, or you can text DA in your message to 64636. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, in today for Dan and Amy. Give us a call, 312-642-5600 to be part of the program with us. Let's go to line one and Chuck. Chuck, good morning.
Hey, how you doing? This is Chuck from Delvin, first-time caller, long-time listener. Hey, I don't know if you've seen that internet picture of Nancy Pelosi getting her shot. The cap was still on the needle. I don't know, unless it was doctored up. Hey, they can have my shot, and my whole thing is I think that they might have purchased too many shots already, because I really don't know anybody in my whole circle going out drinking, sitting in bars and talking and just going anywhere, feeding the pigs. Nobody that I know said that they're going to take the vaccine. So I think the government might have already overspent and wasted a lot of money. Thank you.
Well, so, I mean, I guess we will find out. I mean, we'll find out in terms of how many people do end up taking the vaccine. Well, yeah. We will find out the answer there. Look, if the point is that you can't trust a lot of these people, I mean, just look at, you know, Anthony Fauci, who's now defending the fact that he has been moving the goalposts on herd immunity because he said it was basing on what he thought people were ready to hear. Well, the CDC's own guidance on how to handle a pandemic includes be honest about what you don't know, especially.
Yeah, that should have been a bigger story when he's basically saying that he's been lying for
for
our own benefit.
Yes. It's this elite conceit of, oh, the hoi polloi, the great unwashed masses, they're not ready to hear this information, so we're going to lie to them. Their own procedure is to be honest, especially about what they don't know, and they haven't been doing it. That is something for people to be pissed off about.
And not even just withholding a piece of information, lying about it, giving a different piece of information because
right.
we weren't ready for it because we're toddlers or something.
Right.
That
right.
should have been a huge deal.
No, you should be honest with people, and you might find, you just might discover that they are ready and capable to handle that kind of information. But it's only this kind of arrogance of people who think they have to lie to us that tells them, oh, people can't handle it. It's just, it's annoying.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning. Chicago's Morning Answer, Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. Be a part of the program with us by giving us a call at 312-642-5600. That's 312-642-5600. Or you can text us. Text DA and your message to 64636. It's DA and your message to 64636. You can find Joe and I hosting the program Sources with Knowledge, which is weekends on this station, News Talk 560, The Answer, Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. and then again at 3 p.m. on Sundays. Just look us up, search Sources with Knowledge at wherever you get fine podcasts, and you'll find our relatively decent podcast amongst all of those fine podcasts
yeah.
that are available there.
They should have more of a standard. Spotify really lets you upload anything.
Yeah.
There's a gazillion, I think that's a scientific amount, of podcasts out there. And they're all...
It's a technical term.
They're
yeah.
all ranging from ranges of quality. And we're somewhere right in the middle part of the curve. Not showing off, not falling behind.
You know, we're not one of those elitists. You know, you're really just going to find us in the meaty part of the bell curve, which you may not want to get your brain surgeon from there, but you can get your podcast from there. And you'll generally be fine for it.
Both essential.
Both essential. Truly essential services. Won't somebody please look out for us radio hosts and podcasters? Truly essential services in these troubled times. Yesterday, Joe, we talked about how gratitude, people having a bigger sense of gratitude for how good things are despite the problems and the troubled times we're living through. We talked earlier in the program today about what I thought was my favorite program, TV program from 2020, which was Ted Lasso, which I said there is a theme running through there of forgiveness for people who have been wronged. I think about that in context of this story from the New York Times. And story out of Leesburg, Virginia, the headline, a racial slur, a viral video, and a reckoning. Jimmy Galligan was in history class last school year when his phone buzzed with a message. Once he clicked on it, he found a 3-second video of a white classmate looking into the camera and uttering an anti-black racial slur. The slur, he said, was regularly hurled in classrooms and hallways throughout his years in the Loudoun County School District. He brought the issue up to teachers and administrators, but much to his anger and frustration, his complaints had gone nowhere. So he held on to the video, which was sent to him by a friend, and made a decision that would ricochet across Leesburg, Virginia, a town named for an ancestor of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and whose school system had fought an order to desegregate for more than a decade after the Supreme Court's landmark ruling. Quote, Mr. Galligan, I wanted to get her where she would understand the severity of that word. Which is, he tucked the video away, deciding to post it publicly when the time was right. The time that was right, according to Mr. Galligan, was to make it public and make it known to the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, where this person was going to be going to college. And in doing so, got the University of Tennessee to back away from admitting this student. As I read this story, one, to come back to the point of forgiveness, high schoolers are idiots.
Oh, very much so.
And there's no reason to use racial slurs like that. There's also no reason that one's life should be permanently ended. This new public religion that we're living through right now of perpetual atonement and no forgiveness. No forgiveness and perpetual atonement. But I look at the story and I see people who have been commenting on it trying to ascribe different levels of blame to either the student that used the racial slur or Mr. Galligan, who made it public in order to hurt the person who used it where he thought it would hurt the most. And I think they're missing the two parties that I think should get more attention here. The administrators, the University of Tennessee, who apparently thought that it was necessary because a student did something stupid and awful, that the student should not enter a university, theoretically there for the purpose of forming people into better people, more educated people.
Yeah, they're not getting 18-year-olds that are, if they were perfect, you don't need to mold them into anything.
Exactly.
And you're not needed as an institution.
And there's a lack of character education out there, and there's a lot of problems with all of that. But theoretically, this is why institutions of higher learning should exist, to educate people. Okay. The other, the New York Times, who you know there was a meeting where a bunch of reporters and a bunch of editors all sat around listening to the story and went, gripping. Really needs to be a big article in the newspaper of record for the entire nation. This wasn't a story that, to me, really needed reporting, at least in this sense, other than to focus on not the angle that they took, but the angle of, like, this is not healthy. This is not a way for a society to operate. This is not a way for people to live.
That was my takeaway, was we should never have read about this, really. We should never have read this story. And if we were going to read this story, it's about how the university then did not want her to be there.
Yeah.
That would be the story. We shouldn't have read any of this. It's weird. I mean, we go through this thing with lack of forgiveness through entertainment, through sports, all kinds of things where we're dealing with adults, with professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing. The whole canceling thing of comedians and actors and athletes, that's one thing. But then we apply the same standard to 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds that we don't even know. And it's the fact that we don't know them that makes it easy. That makes people to pile on. That makes it easy for them. Because if you knew an 18-year-old personally who you heard say the N-word, you'd be like, hey, come on. Like, you'd
right.
talk to them. And
right.
you would know them. They're a more complicated person than that one moment when they used a racial slur.
To buttress your point, Joe, it's not just that we're talking about an 18- or 19-year-old. Mimi Groves, who's the person whose admission to the University of Tennessee was revoked, in what the Times points out, is one of at least a dozen universities who have revoked admission offers after videos. And I always love this term, emerged. Nothing emerged in this case. This person posted it with the explicit purpose of hurting.
And they say that, too.
This person, they're explicit about it, but it's always this thing that happens, too, with, like, high draft picks in Major League Baseball or the NBA, where people go spelunking through their Twitter feed to find things that they posted when they were 15 years old. And then the reporting about it is questionable tweets emerged. They didn't emerge.
Exactly. Josh Allen
posted them.
Josh Allen, quarterback for the Buffalo Bills, is having a great season, one of the best seasons the Bills have had in like 30 years. That when he was drafted, they dug up tweets that he had when he was like 15 or 16
right.
that were a little insensitive.
And to the point here, this girl was 15 years old when this happened.
We all
do
dumb things.
18-year-olds are idiotic. And again, don't use racial slurs. I feel like Alex Trebek on Celebrity Jeopardy. What did we say about ethnic slurs? You shouldn't do that. But something you do when you are 15, short of murdering someone, short of causing irreparable physical, emotional, true emotional harm to people, should not be the end of your life. It shouldn't deny you the opportunity to go to an educational institution. That's not to excuse saying the word. It is to point out that we need some kind of a sense of forgiveness in this society and an opportunity for people to truly learn from their mistakes.
Yeah, forgiveness and then learning why, if you're a 15-year-old and you use a word like that, learning why it was wrong. It's a learning experience so you can become a better person when you're 18, when you're 25, when you're 35, when you're a parent, when you're a spouse. That's the thing. Think about your own life, because we can all only think about our own experiences. Think about the growth you had between 15 and 18. I think about myself as a 15-year-old and 18-year-old, and I was dumb in both versions and still to this day. But from 15 to 18 was a remarkable difference in my head and maturity. From 18 to 22, remarkable difference. Between 22 to 25, you can't pigeonhole this person in who they are at 15. You're saying they can't go to college. So they're always going to be this failure that they were at 15, not because they're not going to get a chance to grow, but because you're telling them that they can't, that you're telling them that you'll never look at them any differently. And that's just so wrong.
Continuing this article, Ms. Grove said the video began as a private Snapchat message to a friend. Quote, "At the time, I didn't understand the severity of the word or the history and context behind it because I was so young," she said in a recent interview, adding that the slur was in, quote, "all the songs we listen to, and I'm not using that as an excuse." People wanting to impute to 15-year-olds a deep understanding of the complex history of this country when it has to do with race, which we don't do a good job of teaching about, which we don't do a good job of educating people about the history of this country. And to the extent that we do, we educate them to hate this country and not to understand that, yes, slavery was a blot on the moral conscience of this country. But what is remarkable about this country's history with slavery is not that we had it. It is go back to the Bible. There was slavery. There's been slavery for pretty much ever since we developed agriculture. It's not that we had it, it's that we fought a war to get rid of it. We do not put these things in context well for people in education, and we should be surprised that a 15-year-old doesn't completely understand the context of that. 15-year-olds are often idiots.
I know 30-year-olds that don't understand that context.
It is an immutable fact of life. You are born into this world completely ignorant and only get less so as you get less young.
Here's the thing that's the most frustrating to me, too, is when these occurrences happen. Sometimes, even when they're excused, let's say, just an example, Kevin Hart was going to host the Oscars. They found jokes he made on Twitter from 10 years ago that were considered homophobic. He probably wouldn't make those jokes today.
Mm-hmm.
He still didn't end up hosting the Oscars. But even when it was excused, people say, you know, it was 10 years ago. What about for this girl? What if this is her 10 years ago? Like, we're all having your 10 years ago moment. You're always growing and learning. And so you can say, oh, that's 10 years ago. I said something in terms of 10 years ago, but I've moved past that. Well, she's going to have to move past this. Somebody else is going to have to move. You have your moment where you're dumb, you're ignorant, and then you move past it. And you have to learn and grow, and you need to let them.
You miss the opportunity to actually have a teaching moment here by posting the video with the intention of inflicting as much pain on this person as possible. I think so many people were missing the point of this story. We know what you think of this. Give us a call at 312-642-5600, or you can text your comment, DA, and your comment to 64636. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy, talking about this New York Times story about a young man who posted a video of a young girl who was a high school classmate of his saying a racial slur, doing it in a way to exact the biggest price from her that he could, and in doing so got the University of Tennessee to revoke her admission to that school. Let's go to line one and Frank in Franklin Park. Frank, good morning.
Good morning. Two quick points. No one's condoning what she did. But, you know, there's a thing in this country called freedom of speech. And I think an interesting question to the university would have been, if a black individual had said the same word, would that black individual had received the same punishment? If the answer is no, then this person has a really good cause to sue the university for racial injustice.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Frank. Not a lawyer. Will not comment on the lawsuit part of it. But there's a free speech aspect here in the sense that there are culture of free speech problems. And I don't think that includes the freedom to say racial slurs. You can say it, but there will also be consequences associated to you saying things like that, which is to say that if you know better and you truly know better, don't say things like that. But for a 15-year-old, we should look to have a little bigger sense of forgiveness for teenagers being idiots.
That's what I was going to say. The consequences is what's important. Is like, I don't know if you remember Riley Cooper. He was a wide receiver for the Philadelphia Eagles years ago, and he was caught on camera saying a bunch of racial slurs. He was fined by the team, I think, and then probably did some kind of sensitivity training. Those are the consequences. He had the right legally to be an idiot on camera, but the consequences as a professional and sort of a role model is you got fined. This case, you're a 15-year-old, you don't know better. The consequences are different.
Yeah. Go to line two, Frank in Arlington Heights. Frank, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Well, I'll tell you, this whole incident really just kind of shows something I've been thinking about the last really couple months since the election. And, you know, this country is now no longer uninvadable by a foreign power. And these are just two more reasons why. We would basically be fighting each other, number one, if we did get invaded. And number two, we have so many adults in the world who are just making so much money that they're so soft that they can't ever make any rational judgments about anything. I mean, what this girl did was bad, but I mean, should her whole life have been destroyed? No, but we have these adults who are so afraid of everything that they just, you know, cave on anything. That they'll never make any rational judgments to balance any interest. It's always just cave.
Frank, thanks for your call, Frank. I mean, decline is a choice. We don't have to be a nation in decline. We don't have to be a nation fighting ourselves. And whether or not the clarifying moment of if we were invaded would change things, I kind of think that it would. But, you know, this is the kind of decadence we've sank into, is that we're fighting each other about things like this that just don't seem necessary to fight ourselves in this kind of a way. Let's go to line one, Maurice in Berwyn. Good morning, Maurice.
Good morning. You know, life is not a game of golf. You don't get mulligans sometimes. And life is unfair. Human beings learn from negative consequences sometimes. She'll be fine. She lost this opportunity, but there's other opportunities that are coming down the road. Sometimes we learn from negative outcomes. That's just the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Maurice. Yeah. But this is different than that. This is negative consequences as someone tried to inflict them on someone to give the worst possible outcome. There is no intent to help someone learn from this. This is vitriolic and vengeful.
Yeah, and I agree with the sentiment that you should learn from this, but you're not giving her the opportunity to learn from it.
Right.
It's completely different.
You're seeking to exact a punishment on someone. That is different than giving somebody the opportunity to learn. And a little compassion, a little forgiveness, I think can go a long way for all of that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohen, Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy. The story we were talking about was the repercussions of a video that was posted of a young girl from Virginia having said a racial slur that got her admission to the University of Tennessee revoked. I'm going to turn our attention now to the culture of speech on college campuses themselves. A recent report from College Pulse, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, and Real Clear Education ranks colleges based on the freedom of speech students have available to them on the campus. This has been a hotly debated topic for a good while now, and to discuss this report, we're joined now by Nathan Harden, who is an editor at Real Clear Education. Nathan, thanks so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
So tell us more about this report. So this takes a look at universities, colleges all across the United States. And it is, as it says, it's based on a rigorous analysis of five distinct aspects of free speech climate on campus for students surveyed. Tell us more about this report and what it found.
Sure. Well, this is the largest survey of students on the topic of free speech that's ever been conducted. Almost 20,000 students at the 55 universities that we included in the initial survey. And what this large sample enabled us to do is to actually go down to the level of seeing the differences in the free speech climate between one campus and another. So we set it up, and people can go to realclear-education.com and check this out for themselves. But we set this up on a point scale and in a ranking system, much like, you know, people have heard of the U.S. News, you know, top colleges or whatever that come out every year. Yeah, this is a similar idea, but it's based on the climate of free expression coming from the source themselves, the students themselves. So we asked them questions in various areas. What ideas were they tolerant of or open to hearing? Were they open to hearing controversial views expressed on campus, controversial speakers and so forth? Did they feel that the administration supported their rights to express themselves openly and freely? And do they feel, free to speak openly among their peers or in front of their professors? And finally, we took a look at the speech codes as well that might be in the student handbook and things like that. And we pieced all these bits of information into a point scale from 0 to 100 and ranked them accordingly. So this is really a chance for whether it's a parent that has a student applying to college or a student who's looking at colleges that interest them. It's another important piece of information that's never been available before.
You could find it at realclear-education.com/speech. And I'm there right now and looking. And good news for people here locally in the Chicagoland area, the number one overall, best overall school, the University of Chicago. And the only downside
is
the low, low price of $58,230 a year, which is, a bit of a premium to pay for being the best school there. But at least good to see that a local school here is kind of tops among that. And one of the highest points that I see is they get is administrative support. And that is one thing we have heard about here, and at least I've heard a lot about here in Chicago, is that the University of Chicago, on a lot of these kind of crazy stories, they've been really, really good about this stuff.
That's right. Robert Zimmer, the president there, has taken a very proactive approach to the issue of free speech on campus. And what we find, one of the takeaways from these rankings is that the administration can really make a huge impact if they prioritize this issue. You just mentioned, as we were opening the segment, this story about this young girl who got her admission to University of Tennessee revoked. And I think what that story and many like it points to is that there's a real climate just in our culture right now on social media and so forth where, people are policing speech. They're looking for someone's sort of worst moment that they can capture and bring up at a later time. And that creates an environment of fear where, everybody fears that, they say something, hateful or stupid or whatever, that's going to follow them for the rest of their days. And we got a lot of that kind of feedback in our survey that students were more afraid of being socially ostracized for their political views than they were, even afraid, say, of the professor, disagreeing with them or the administration cracking down on them in some overt way. So what we find is there's a lot of things stacked against free speech and open inquiry before kids even arrive on campus. In a place like University of Chicago, that they've come out with a famous Chicago statement, or what's become known as the Chicago Statement on Free Speech on campus, and really saying, hey, this is a place where we're going to protect the widest possible range of views to be expressed openly and debated freely. And that's you know, almost don't come to Chicago if you don't want to encounter views that, that are different from your own. That's kind of the culture they've established there. So that's a big reason why students rank the administrative support for free speech so highly. Yeah, that being said, things aren't perfect there either, right? And you know, we've seen, you know, there was a student just earlier this year who wrote something publicly, you know, speaking out against socialism or something.
Yeah.
They ended up getting, you know, threatened on campus.
Right.
People saying, yeah, you should leave. So I think, you know, nothing's perfect. None of these schools are perfect. But what we're seeing is that, you know, some of these schools are measurably better on the topic of free speech.
Yeah, that administrative score for Chicago really jumps out because no other school really comes close. But also their self-expression score, that category, no one really comes that close to that either. But theirs is still relatively low. I mean, it's in the 50s. What goes into the self-expression category? What do you weigh with that?
Well, self-expression is really a series of questions asking, you know, do you feel comfortable speaking openly about your views in various contexts, whether that was with peers or in front of professors? And across the board, that tended to be the lowest score at almost every school. So that brings up the point I mentioned earlier, that there's a real element of negative peer pressure, you know, fear of that kind of social or cultural alienation that could happen and a lot of times we see this difference when we looked at, for instance, how conservative, politically conservative students felt in a campus that was predominantly liberal, or how liberal students felt in a more conservative leaning campus. And we could see that the more that a student was in the minority ideologically, the more likely they were to feel hesitant to express themselves openly, right? It's easy to express yourself when everyone around you agrees with you, of course. But one of the things that was interesting about Chicago is that both liberal and conservative students ranked it relatively high, very highly, you know, across the board. And we didn't find that everywhere. So there were a lot of liberal-leaning schools like Chicago where conservatives, you know, ranked this free speech environment very, very low. But that wasn't the case there. And we really attribute that to the proactive approach that Robert Zimmer and the rest of the administration at Chicago have taken on this issue. They've really become recognized as leaders in the area of academic freedom and free speech. So that speaks well of the climate they've created there.
The culture and the student-created culture is interesting to me. With the point that you made about, you know, it's easy to express yourself when everyone around you agrees with you. You know, it's been a while since I was in college. It was 2000 to 2004. But I was an ideological minority on a small liberal arts campus in the middle of in the middle of Illinois. I had a newspaper column. I restarted the College Republicans while I was there. I did not... And look, did I get, you know, blowback isn't even the right word. Did people disagree with me? Certainly. But I had no hesitation whatsoever. I felt no problem about expressing the views that I had at the time. And there seems to be a marked difference in the culture that is being created by the students that are there that are almost, you know, in different aspects, seemingly asking now for like an in loco parentis kind of administration at the school, that they want the school to protect them from other views, which was just, it is a completely foreign thing to me, given my experience, which of course now is quite dated.
Yes. And, you know, we had this new concept that arose in our culture since you were in school. And that is the idea that words themselves are a form of violence, right? You hear this sometimes, in the rhetoric, and that actually in our support across the board, 42% of students said they believe that the administration would punish a speaker for offensive expression. So there's a sense that, you know, everybody's for free speech if you just ask them, hey, are you for free speech? But when you actually get down to the nitty-gritty of, hey, would you support allowing this person to come in and speak on campus whose views you find reprehensible. And that's where we find that, well, actually, a lot of us aren't as comfortable and supportive of free speech as we might think of ourselves to be. And so we were looking at, you know, in really over these last couple of decades, a real tightening of the bounds of what's acceptable to say. And I think along with that, we're seeing greater polarization. You know, the left is getting more left, the right is getting more right, and we're not talking to each other as freely and openly. And really, you know, that's not what a college campus is supposed to be about. I think most of us think, you know, university, this is a place where you're supposed to be able to freely debate ideas and counter opposing views, kind of examine your own beliefs. And if there's a quelching of free speech, whether it's in the classroom or even if it's among your peers, your fellow students, that's not going to happen. And so it really diminishes the educational experience, and students just come out, you know, with more or less an echo chamber, getting their own prior beliefs reinforced rather than having them challenged or modified in a sense by exposure to ideas that could expand their views.
That's why I think it's really interesting that you also rank this by what liberal students thought, what conservative students thought. Because as you said, everyone, and at least in the abstract, supports free speech, but through that ideological breakdown, you're going to get different perspectives about what that means, really. Did you see any outliers when looking between what liberals thought and what conservatives thought?
Well, you know, across the board, the biggest difference was that, you know, when liberals were in the majority somewhere, they tended to feel more comfortable speaking, right? Because they're around people who agree with them. And the same was true of conservatives. And I think we saw something of a difference between the elite schools and more of the larger public state universities. Chicago is a little bit of an exception in this category because it's, you know, a very selective elite private university, but yet it came out number one. On the whole, though, 7 of the top 10 in our survey were public state universities, and 7 of the bottom 10 were private universities, including 2 Ivy League schools. So there seems to be a little bit of a separate category, in a sense, for these elite schools that may be more highly charged political environments. For instance, at Stanford, you know, one of the most prestigious universities in the country, 42% of the students there told us that they think it's acceptable to shout down a speaker whose views you find offensive in at least some circumstances. And that number was only 13% at Kansas State, another, you know, more of a less selective public university in our survey. And those are, you know, an example of the difference that you might get when you're talking about these more elite schools. We also saw some differences geographically that, you know, sometimes in the Northeast, there tended to be a more hostile environment to free speech that shows up on our survey rather than some other geographic areas of the country. That also happens to be where a lot of these elite schools are located, right?
Right.
So it's just very interesting to think that you're paying more, in a sense, for these elite private schools, but are you getting the same quality of free expression? And then overall, the answer is no, although we want to cite those exceptions in places like University of Chicago where they are doing a good job.
Fascinating report. Encourage people to check it out. You can find it at realclear.com/speech. Nathan Harden is an editor at Real Clear Education. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Erico and Joe Kaiser in for Dan and Amy today. Text from 5537 wanted to know where Dan Prof School ranked. Of course, Dan went to Northwestern. You'd be surprised to find out Northwestern, in terms of overall rankings, number 17. Hmm. Number 17. Only 43.5 out of 100 on the self-expression, but that administrative support, 69.6, openness, 64.5, tolerance, 50. Speech code is yellow, which is not great. That's a fire ranking. Encourage you to check out the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education and their rankings of those things. But that's, not as bad as one might have thought that it would be.
And it's saying something because go check out the report, but the University of Chicago admin support ranking was, 91 or something, and nothing else came into the 70s, I think. It's remarkable the scores that Chicago got.
If you can afford it and get into the University of Chicago, those are big ifs. I mean, $58,000 a year and only 6% acceptance rate. I remember that statement coming out from them, and that it did stand out kind of in a way that a lot of the Twitter mob stuff, if people just let it endure it for 48 hours, in most cases, it just goes away. People move on to something else. And it's a similar thing, I think, happening at that university where they're just kind of we're just not going to do this, guys. You can kick and scream all you want, but we are not going to participate in the same kind of tearing down rituals and ridiculousness that you find at other campuses. And kudos to the University of Chicago for that.
And then you become an outlier school. You become, and this is why we're talking about it as such, they're the exception. And then you have this reputation instead of just being one of the other schools that hates free speech.
Yes. And in that sense, you distinguish yourself even more, especially for parents out there who are afraid of this kind of stuff, who think that this environment that they're sending their young kids into, their idiot 18-year-olds, as we discussed earlier, it is an opportunity. If you can get into the University of Chicago, at least go check out that report and find out where these schools rank. Very, very interesting information there.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Chicago's Morning Answer. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. I want you to be a part of the program with us. You can do that by giving us a call. 312-642-5600. That's 312-642-5600 to be a part of the program with us. Or if you ain't the talking type, you can text us. Just text DA and your message to 64636. That's DA and your message to 64636. You can find Joe and I hosting the program Sources with Knowledge, heard on this station, News Talk 560, The Answer, weekends, 8 a.m. on Saturday morning, and then again at 3 p.m. on Sunday afternoon. You can find us in your friendly local podcast feed by searching Sources with Knowledge, and we encourage you to check us out there. We hope you'll like it, but at minimum, we hope you'll tolerate it. In a lot of people I know, when I've heard them talk about, they've written a book, and I've heard this line before, that it would be great if people read the book, but it's more important that you buy it.
Sure.
And it would be great if you listen to our podcast, but it's more important that you just subscribe.
Yeah, leave a 5-star review. And I don't care if it's actually 5 stars. I don't care if you actually listen to it. 5 stars helps the little algorithm. It helps us. And then if you want to listen to it, more power to you.
Yep.
You might like it. You might like some of it. You might be like, eh.
That's the thing.
It won't hurt you.
It is a thing that exists on the internet.
Yeah, and not everybody can say that besides a lot of people.
Besides all 10 billion other podcasters that exist as a result of this pandemic.
Yeah,
but, hey, what are you going to do? Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we are going to be talking with Austin Berg, who is the Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute, about what is going to be coming in January, where you'll have the inauguration of the Illinois State Legislature, and for the first time in forever, there is an open question as to whether or not long-running Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan will continue to be Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. And that is going to have a huge influence on what is going to happen in this state over the course of 2021 and into 2022, where Governor J.B. Pritzker will be up for re-election. And the big gambit by J.B. Pritzker, according to him, to address the state's financial problems was to institute a progressive income tax, which was on the ballot in November, lost pretty handily. And now Pritzker is having to deal with the consequences of that. And you did hear from some members of the legislature in true Illinois style of just being so clearly and obviously in touch with the citizens of this state, where by 10 points, citizens of this state said, your tax increase plan, we don't want that. And those politicians, to their credit, listened to what the voters had to say, took it to heart, processed it, mulled it over a little bit, sipped a cup of coffee as they thought it over, and came back and said, okay, we hear you. You don't want us to raise your taxes. So what if instead we raised your taxes? It is the most Illinois thing ever, other than what Governor Pritzker is doing now, which is he's laid out $700 million in cuts, while at the same time blaming Republicans in the state of Illinois for not offering alternatives after working to scuttle his graduated income tax plan, which is hilarious to me. Because if there is one thing, if there is one entity in the state that has no power whatsoever, it is the Illinois Republican Party, which the regular host of this program, Dan Proft, I know refers to as a legal fiction. And you know what, Joe? He's not wrong about that.
Yeah, often the super minority party. It's just, it's kind of comical. I think after the fair tax failed, he went and blamed the Republicans again, too.
Yeah, he blamed Bruce Rauner, which was hilarious if, like, the best thing that came out of the Rauner administration was a full 2 years after he was out of office.
Right. Don't blame, like, Bruce Rauner got nothing done, like, nothing accomplished at all. He's long gone. I don't even think he lives in the state anymore. You don't really have to blame him for
anything.
Is he
in, like, Italy or something like that?
I've heard Italy. I've heard Montana. I don't know. He has multiple houses. Good for him. But it's just silly because the fair tax, like you said, failed by 10 points. And this isn't one of these February Chicago elections, like, obscure thing that no one's voting for. This isn't a presidential election where Joe Biden obviously carried Illinois. So you have Biden voters, you have Democrats, probably partisan Democrats too, and liberals who are saying, yeah, no, I don't trust Illinois politicians with this new power to raise my taxes indefinitely.
A fascinating line in this Tribune story from back on December 15th. Republicans quickly countered that the budget problems were self-inflicted by Democrats who enacted what Illinois House GOP leader Jim Durkin called a fantasy budget that hinged on voter approval of Pritzker's proposed graduated rate income tax and a, quote, fingers crossed hope for a federal bailout that has not materialized. And the news for Governor Pritzker and for a lot of Democrats that were, I know, thinking, okay, looking at how they thought the election was going to go, Joe Biden will be in the White House, going to take control of the Senate, we're going to be able to get through a bailout, or at least relief to the states, if not just a full bailout of the state's beleaguered public pension system. None of that help is coming. It's like, if you remember, I actually saw, it was on this weekend, the movie Braveheart. Mm-hmm. You know, like Mel Gibson's love interest in the beginning of that, where she's about to be executed for whatever her crimes were. She's like scanning the horizon looking for Mel Gibson to come save her, and he doesn't arrive. That is like J.B. Pritzker right now. He is up against the post, ready to have his throat slit, and he's scanning the horizon looking for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris coming riding in on a giant bailout for the state. It is not coming. It's not going to happen.
We've talked a lot today and yesterday about the lack of imagination and creativity from government and bureaucrats. imagine the lack of imagination from a policymaker, from a governor, to think that your only options going forward are some sort of tax increase, whether the voters are going to do it to themselves or I'm just going to have to do it to you, some sort of cuts that don't make any sense, that no one's asking for and that aren't necessary, or a combination of a bailout that's just not coming. There's none of these address any of the state's problems and why the state's in the condition it's in. There's no imagination behind them at all. They're not creative. They're not actually fixing the structural problems of the state. But this is the guy who's in charge theory, this is all I can come up with.
Yes, very, very, very large and in charge and trying to offer these solutions for the state of Illinois. There's no solutions there. And the hilarity of blaming Republicans for having not offered any solutions. If you set the Republican Party aside for a moment, we all agree that we should all be able to agree that in the Illinois context, the Illinois Republican Party is a joke, has been a joke for a long time. It took someone like Bruce Rauner, who dumped millions and millions of his own money to get himself barely over the hump now 6 years ago. So let's set that all aside. It's not like there haven't been ideas out there. You know, we're going to talk to Austin Berg at the bottom of the hour from the Illinois Policy Institute. The Illinois Policy Institute puts out a proposed budget every single year where they lay out, here's what you could do to fix these structural problems in a way that is not a shock to the system. It is not saying we're going to rip pensions away from people, that we're going to make massive cuts in all kinds of state services. That's not what's even being proposed there. It is a system that walks us away from the structural problems, but fixes the structure and allows the state to be on a trajectory to getting its house in order. We're going to talk tomorrow to someone else from Illinois Policy Institute, Orphy Duvangy, who is their chief economist, about the out-migration problem. And that is, you know, not only is there not a bailout coming from Washington, the biggest problem, it has been for a while and will be going forward until the state shows it's willing to do something serious, is that people aren't going to stick around to pay the tab on this thing. They are fleeing. I've known a number of people who have left Chicago just for pandemic reasons. Because why be in Chicago if you can't do any of the fun things in Chicago?
Even within Chicago, why be the housing prices in the loop? Like, why be in the loop if you're not commuting to an office there? We're seeing that just within Chicago alone. People don't want to be downtown. The people don't want to be the city at large and then, you know, go to the suburbs. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense to be in the city when there's nothing open.
I've got friends who are talking about moving out of the state and looking at places that are hot and growing, like Nashville, where you can take a house where you're paying $20,000 a year now in property taxes living out in the suburbs of Chicago, move to Nashville, same house, you're going to pay $2,500 in a state with zero income tax. It's almost as if these kinds of policies that these states have chosen affect the desirability of people living there.
Sure.
It's remarkable.
Don't even go to Nashville, where the weather's a little bit nicer and it's a growing city. Let's even stay closer in the same climate, Northwest Indiana. Like, I have no personal desire to move to Northwest Indiana, but comp the housing difference. Like, you can move to Northwest Indiana from any given suburb in Chicago. You're still potentially within the same distance to the city of Chicago. So if you want the everything the city has to offer, you can hop on a train, South Shore Line, and get to Chicago within 30 minutes and pay ridiculously less for a bigger house.
Yeah, at that point, why wouldn't you? I mean, even other states within the Midwest area, 15 years ago, the idea of, like, hey, you should move to Michigan seemed crazy. Michigan is a far more attractive state than Illinois right now. What Governor Pritzker is doing in offering, and we talked about this yesterday, of offering up, it's always the first thing. It's like Pat Quinn did this all the time, too. We're going to cut hospitals and police and firefighters, and that's the way that we're going to balance the budget here. Unless you give me the tax increase that I say I want, that's never going to fix our problems because our problems are structural. It's a joke. It should be regarded as a joke. And serious people should be invited in to fix the problem. You've got serious solutions. Give us a call, 312-642-5600, to be a part of the program with us today. Or text your message, DA in your message, to 646-36. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. Join us by giving us a call at 312-642-5600 or texting your message to DA and your message to 64636. We've been talking about what's going to be facing the state of Illinois coming up in this next year, as it will have to pass a budget and will have to grapple with not only the problems of the pandemic that the pandemic has created, but also the long-running problems that the state of Illinois has had. We want to know what you think about that. Let's go to line one and John in Mundelein. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I know my opinion is not exactly popular on right-wing ideology radio, but I will tell you my view is that I don't envy any governor who has to make the tough decision between closing businesses to try to prevent the spread of COVID, knowing that some of those businesses will not survive, or allowing people to continue to go to those businesses and leaving all those businesses open, letting people go out and spread the virus, knowing that some of them won't survive. And my opinion is that it is not any governor, Republican or Democrat, who is really the problem in helping those businesses to survive the lockdown. It's my opinion that it's Mitch McConnell. And I know you said the government isn't going to come with a bailout. You know, I work for a small business that has 5 employees. I received unemployment when we were first shut down because of COVID. And then my business got a PPP loan. Mm-hmm. Both of those federal programs literally saved my life and saved the business I worked for.
To the point you're talking about here, we talked on this program yesterday that my preferred policy plan for how to deal with this, rather than doing the stimulus checks we've been doing, would be to have the federal government backstop private payrolls to keep people attached to their jobs, to keep them attached to their benefits. I think that would have been a better plan. I think you can lay plenty of criticism at the feet of Congress, and I am not short of any criticism of Congress. But as far as governors go, they run for the job of making difficult decisions. I don't, you know, I agree that I don't envy them for having to make them, but that's the job they asked for.
Right, I understand that, but I agree with you about that. But the governor, the state, doesn't have the capacity to help businesses the way the federal government has in the past. And I see the obstacle to that happening to a greater extent and a more effective extent to be the responsibility of Senate Republicans, not governors. I think the bad guy in all of this has been Mitch McConnell, dragging his feet to actually help people. And I think that it helps him politically when everybody just blames their governor and has their Pritzker sucks sign in their front yard. Mitch McConnell is served politically by people filling the Capitol building in Lansing and saying, liberate Michigan. It's all Gretchen Whitmer's fault. Well, Mitch McConnell is the one standing in the way of really helping people.
John, thanks so much for your call.
I mean, there's plenty of blame to go around.
There's plenty of blame to go around. You can also blame Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats. You can blame the entire operation of the federal government. It can't do everything. And more to the point of what we've been talking about in the last segment was the state of Illinois had these problems before the pandemic happened. The pandemic may have made it worse, but the state of Illinois was still going to be absolutely up crap creek without a paddle, even if the pandemic didn't happen.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, what we've been talking about in the last 30 minutes is just that this has been going on for decades and decades and decades, and it's kind of disingenuous for Governor Pritzker to point to the pandemic as a reason, and he did that when he was pushing the fare tax, pointing to the pandemic as a reason why the state needs more revenue.
Yeah, you want a reason why the state is not in a position to help more businesses? It's precisely because the state has accrued $250+ billion in unfunded pension liabilities. It's because this state operates as a banana republic rather than an actual functional state. States in better financial positions, amazingly enough, were better positioned to be able to help people when they needed to. Because the government does so many things, particularly in this state, that it doesn't need to be doing, rings up so many costs that it wasn't able to be in a position to help with all of that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Kara Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. Be part of the program with us. Give us a call at 312-642-5600 or text your message to DA64636, DA and your message to 64636. One of the most important things that's going to happen in the state of Illinois is going to happen in the beginning of the year, in January, where the new legislature will be inaugurated. And one of the first things that they will do is they will vote on who will be the Speaker of the House in Illinois. And for the first time in a long time, seemingly forever, it is not clear that the fait accompli of the last 40 years, that Mike Madigan would be the Speaker of the House, is going to happen. And we will only find out when that vote actually occurs. But there have been 19 Illinois House Democrats who have said that they will not vote to return Mike Madigan to that office.
The problem is they're starting to learn that this Madigan guy might be up to no good.
Yeah. I mean, you need a few decades to figure that kind of stuff out. Yeah. But
I haven't decided myself. I still don't know.
Someone who knows a lot about Illinois Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, joins us now. He is Austin Berg. He's Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute. Austin, thanks so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good to be with you.
So this is unprecedented. We've had only little fits in the past of present votes and people posturing, but 19 House Democrats saying they will not vote to reelect Madigan as Speaker and recently issuing a statement altogether is one of the most significant developments in recent Illinois political history. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It's totally unprecedented. Previously, we've only ever seen in a given General Assembly one House Democrat take a present vote for Speaker. That was Ann Stava Murray most recently, Scott Drury before that. And then you have to go back to the 80s to find another present vote for Speaker. So Madigan has said, and he doesn't say things like this publicly often, that his most important vote is the vote for Speaker, not on any one policy, not on taxes, not on ethics. The most important vote to Mike Madigan is the vote for Speaker, and he's completely lost control of it. You have 19 House Democrats. That leaves him 6 votes short of the 60 votes he needs for Speaker. Now, what's interesting is we're seeing kind of an unstoppable force meet an immovable object, because the Black Caucus, the 21 of the 22 members of the Black Caucus are saying, well, Madigan's our guy. We support him. A challenger would need at least a handful of those members to flip to a non-Madigan vote as well. So it's going to be a barn burner come the second week of January.
Wait, so what is the exact math? I know we've said that 19 have said that they are unlikely to support Madigan, but what is the actual number needed?
You need 60 votes to be Speaker. So if there's 74 House Democrats, 19 of those are saying that they won't vote for Madigan. It's about 6 votes shy.
So I've heard some people comment that there's plenty of reason. Look, it's Illinois. There's plenty of reason to be skeptical that these things aren't actually going to play out the way that they seem to hint that they're going to play out. And that one of the reasons that they're skeptical of this is because there is no declared candidate for Speaker other than Mike Madigan. Do you think that's a significant factor at this point in time, or is it the kind of thing that might actually work to the advantage that somebody emerges at the last minute as a consensus when you don't have enough votes to reinstall Madigan in that position?
Yeah, I think right now that's being kind of overblown, especially by people who favor Madigan. So, for example, what the Black Caucus did is held an open forum for who we should endorse for Speaker. And right now it's Madigan versus Stephanie Kifowit is the only Democrat who has announced her candidacy. While that is a very brave move of her, it doesn't seem like she will be able to wrangle the votes. So essentially Madigan, by working with the Black Caucus to call that forum, is kind of saying, well, put your numbers on the board. You know, there's no other candidate. But of course, the process would always work like it's working right now if you were to depose Madigan as Speaker. First, you have to line up the opposition and make sure that none of those people will defect. And that right now looks really good among those 19 House Democrats. And then finally, at the last possible moment, when it's very clear Madigan does not have the votes, you'll see viable candidates start to pop up. So, you know, I would not be people should not despair about the fact that there isn't a, you know, a very clear candidate for speaker besides Madigan.
Right, because it's really just Madigan versus not Madigan, it seems like, whoever they're going to vote on.
It's the field.
Right, it's the field. Wouldn't it, I mean, he can't get into his head, but wouldn't it be beneficial almost for Pritzker and really the Illinois Democratic Party to have someone else, if we're thinking big picture? I mean, how much do you think Madigan's reputation has hurt Democrats? I know he's like a skilled politician. He gets stuff, historically, gets a lot of stuff done, whatever he wants, but... For example, the fair tax that just failed miserably. How much does Madigan's reputation and Illinois Democrats' reputation over the last few decades, how much does it hurt advancing policies like that?
It hurts a tremendous amount. So Mike Madigan is the most unpopular politician in the state of Illinois. I think Trump lost Illinois by around 17 points. Madigan is way more underwater than that. There's some polls that have his approval rating in the single digits. So he is the face of the Democratic Party, the chair of the Democratic Party of Illinois. He's the, you know, the symbol of all the corruption that's gone on in Illinois for the last few decades. So his presence is enormously harmful. But what Pritzker should be doing and what he's not is not only calling on Madigan to step down, which any good leader should do in the face of the evidence that's been presented in this ComEd case. But he should be calling on things like, you should be calling for things like fair maps. So what Madigan is doing right now, and especially with the Black Caucus and with other factions in the General Assembly, is saying, hey, you need me to draw a good map for you after the 2020 census. And there's no other speaker that's going to treat you like me when it comes to the map. I've done it for three of the last four decades. Nobody else knows how to draw a map as good as me. And what J.B. Pritzker should be saying is, I'm going to veto any map that any politician touches in Illinois. And that neuters Madigan immediately. So that's the way you would have true leadership from a governor, is not only demanding, you know, kind of a new paint job, a new speaker, but some of the structural reforms that would prevent another Madigan from rising in his place, one of which is the map.
Austin, how did we get here? So a lot of the things that you've highlighted about Madigan's legacy, I mean, he first became Speaker of the House. I was born in 82. He became Speaker of the House in 83. A lot of these things have been known for a long time, and yet he endures, and yet he remains, and yet he persists. What has changed over the last couple of years that have led to a point where the House Democratic Caucus that he has always had iron grip control over now has 19 members saying they won't support him anymore?
A couple things. So the reason he's been able to persist is just purely through the consolidation of power that comes from the map, which I mentioned. It comes through money. He's been the chair of the Democratic Party since the mid-90s as well. So he's able to consolidate all the money on the Democrat side of Illinois politics. He also makes an ungodly amount of money appealing property tax bills for the most valuable real estate in the Midwest, in Chicago. And then finally, through the House rules, which allow him to basically have one-man veto power over any piece of legislation he doesn't like. So if you're a utility like ComEd or, you know, a big retailer or any large business in Illinois, it's basically one-stop shopping for your lobbying or bribing or corruption in the General Assembly. That's why he stayed for so long. Now, the reason that the dam is breaking is really because of this federal investigation. You've seen so much of his inner circle wilt away under either indictments or even in the Me Too scandal. Many of his inner circle were forced out. So he's sort of the last man standing, and his perception of power among his caucus reached almost a breaking point, where you have federal investigators looming. It's the largest and deepest corruption investigation in the history of the state, and it's clear who their target is. It's Mike Madigan.
Now, you obviously can't predict this for sure, but let's just pretend that he isn't reelected speaker. I can't really picture Mike Madigan rank and file Democrat House member in 2021. What do you think happens? Not just to him. I don't know if that ends up meaning he'll resign or just not run for re-election. But what does it look like once Mike Madigan is no longer Speaker?
It's total chaos because that chamber has, as you said, 34 of the last 36 years, they only know one way of doing things. And it's a very much an old man daily Chicago machine way of conducting business in Springfield. Nobody else has the parliamentary knowledge that a Madigan has. No one else has the political power that Madigan has. No one's able to align the interests of, for instance, government worker labor unions and the trial bar. All these things, it's almost like Otto von Bismarck, right? Like he is the only man who can keep all of these plates spinning at once. And when he leaves, they will all come crashing down. So it will be very interesting to see what happens. Now, does he stay? You wouldn't think Ed Burke would stay in Chicago City Council after losing the Finance Committee, which he was like the, you know, the Madigan at the city level in Chicago. But yet he stays there, and that's after his indictment. So I think it's tough to say what he'll do if he doesn't win the speakership.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't think that he'd stay, but he's a young man. He's got a long career ahead of him, so maybe it's in his best interest.
Maybe he'll play baseball.
Yeah, he's got the whole world ahead of him. He could run for Senate. He could run for governor. He could run for president. Who knows?
The world is his oyster. Austin, I'm curious. You talked about the rules, the way that he has accumulated and controlled power in the state of Illinois. Is what you're suggesting that, kind of in a way, he is, if you are an adherent to that kind of a philosophy, the old man daily kind of philosophy, he's the indispensable man here, that whoever steps in as speaker, it's going to be somewhat of a disaster because no one else can do the kinds of things that Madigan has been able to do. What do you think, what opportunities do you think will be presented for people who want to see the state reformed and our problems fixed by that chaotic situation?
So I think one of the most encouraging ones would be bringing democracy back to the Illinois House of Representatives. As I said, it's been one-man control. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. So if you put anyone in that seat, there's going to be problems with corruption just because of the authoritarian power that speakership is currently given. And that's really encouraging. And that's something that people from both parties can get behind. And it's been a problem historically with both parties consolidating party power in the speakership in Illinois. So I think rules reform is a big one, opening up the process so people from both sides of the aisle can call bills, can have open debate on things. I think ethics reform is another huge one. Madigan has stood in the way for that for a long time. Term limits for House leadership, an inspector general that actually has some teeth that can investigate corruption in the Illinois General Assembly. And finally, pension reform. I mean, Madigan has sat on his hands on pension reform over the last 6 or 7 years, done absolutely nothing about the biggest public policy problem in the state. And eventually that math catches up with you, and you're going to have other leadership in the Democratic Party that's going to have to confront this problem. So it opens up a number of really amazing opportunities for Illinois.
Austin, what is the timeline here? When are these things going to happen? There's a lot of political wrangling that is going on right now. Of course, we had 19 Illinois House Democrats that we've mentioned who said that they're not going to support Madigan as Speaker. When does all of this happen? How much time is there? Things can change fast in the political world. How much time is left on the clock?
So you've got a vote coming down the pike for Speaker the week of January 10th. It might be around the 13th or the 14th of January. We don't have the final schedule yet. So for folks at home, anyone who has ever cared about the state of Illinois or politics or Mike Madigan, now is the time to reach out to your state lawmaker, whether a Republican or Democrat. If they're a Democrat, you should reach out to them and say and tell them to vote for a different speaker. If they're a Republican, tell them to support things like rules reform, those structural changes that are really important. So people have a couple of weeks here before the rubber meets the road on the speaker vote.
He is Austin Berg, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org. Austin, thanks so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Kirko and Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy. I think it was interesting in what Austin had to say about the opportunity that is created by the circumstance. And yeah, I think we can expect a lot of chaos. It seemed to be fair to expect a lot of chaos. But moving from the situation that we have been in the state for so long, where one person has controlled so much, to a more truly democratic system, small d democratic system, is a good evolution. And as I think about that question, that Madigan is like the irreplaceable person in all of this, Joe, can you imagine what someone with his talents would be able to do if he applied it to something that actually helped people, like something in the private sector, how ingenious he would have been if it weren't just being used as a mechanism to accrue political power to himself and to play the political game he's played for 40 years.
But here's the problem, is the incentive isn't really there. I mean, he probably could have been a successful business person, kind of, in a way. But the incentive, like, think about everything he's been able to do in his position, the power he's been able to accrue over the last 30, 40 years. It's incredible. And where's that incentive for him at any point in the last, since 1983, when was there ever an incentive to go do something else? And you see that in the fact that he's a very talented political actor, but he didn't want another position ever.
Well,
he never wanted to be governor.
I guess I'm talking about, like, somewhere in the multiverse or on Earth 2.
Yeah, no,
Mike Madigan
doesn't
even go into politics.
I totally get it, yeah. But just in this planet, the incentive structure is not really there. But yeah, I mean, he clearly, and that's not complimenting him too much, and not saying that he's like an impressive person in a way that we should admire, but really is an incredibly talented individual in playing 4D chess all the time.
And the incentives do matter. I mean, there's incentive in the state for people with that kind of talent to go into politics rather than going into something, again, that actually does help people. It is a business in this state to an extent that it is largely not. I mean, it was funny. I did a radio program, Beyond the Beltway, over the weekend, which also airs on the station, where one of the other guests was a radio talk show host in Austin, Texas. And he pointed out that, you know, our legislature only meets every couple of years.
They have a stipend, too.
Yeah. It is a completely different system because of the incentives and the way that the structure is. And if the outcome from Mike Madigan no longer being speaker is that some of the reforms that Austin talked about can be implemented in this state will be better off as a result of it. It's got a long way to go, and with Governor Pritzker at the helm, clearly a long way to go, but it is at least the slightest inkling of a light at the end of the tunnel.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.